I'm Brandi Cruz, coming up today on Undivided. Ann Bremner, the attorney for one of the Tacoma police officers acquitted in the death of Manny Ellis, joins us. Also, we show you how state law is quite literally training teachers in our state to be activists. And the unbelievable twisting of a Seattle landlord's story. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. I'm Brandi Cruz. I believe the vast majority of teachers in our state are great. I think they're great people. I think they got into the profession for the right reasons. We talk a lot about missteps from teachers on this show. It's because it's our job to hold the government accountable. It's not our job to praise people who are doing their job as they should. And so, yeah, you know, does it sometimes come across like we think every single teacher in the state is an activist? Maybe. But hopefully people are able to listen to those stories with the context and the nuance that we use. I am concerned that there are an awful lot of teachers in Washington State who have become activists and who are actively indoctrinating kids on political and social issues. By now, we have shared enough stories that I think that there is weight to that argument. But it's also not that you have teachers who enter the profession as activists. Some maybe, sure. But I think you have teachers who get into the profession for the right reasons, who are there to teach the kids, to raise the next generation of thinkers in this country. And then they are themselves as teachers indoctrinated by the state of Washington and by politicians and lawmakers and special interests who craft policy and laws where the result is indoctrinating teachers who then turn around and indoctrinate students. And I want to talk about one of those laws today, but I want to do it through the lens of the state of our public education system in Washington State. We already know that enrollment in public schools is way down. In fact, enrollment for homeschooling in our state is up 500%. Some of that certainly because of the pandemic, parents who found a workaround to school closures and just decided that they were going to continue to go down that route. But I also think it's parents who realize that what's happening in our public schools goes beyond the education of kids. And test scores bear that out. Are test scores the end-all be-all? No. But test scores are a reflection of whether kids are meeting standards that have been set forth. And if you look at the test scores in Washington State right now, they're not good. Only 50% of kids are meeting English language standards. 39% of students are meeting math standards. 43% of students are meeting science standards. Only 67.2% of students in the 2021-2022 school year regularly attended class. All of that, meanwhile, we're spending $17,000 per pupil, which, hey, I'd be fine with that if the outcomes were good. I'd be fine with that if we had kids who were meeting at least at a rate higher than 50%. I mean, that's kind of bottom basement thinking. It's like, is 50% of kids meeting English and math and science standards really too much to ask if we're spending $17,000 per pupil? No. I, as a taxpayer of Washington, I don't think it is. So you keep that in mind. Again, declining enrollment, test scores in the toilet, 67% of kids regularly attending school. And then I want you to listen very closely to what we're going to lay out about some of the priorities of education that's happening in the background, all of that. So a little context that's important here. I want to talk about Senate Bill 5044, which was passed during the 2021 regular session. So again, keep in mind, through this entire conversation, the actual educational quality that kids are getting in this state, which is not good if you compare it to outcomes. So what Senate Bill 5044 did when it was passed in 2021 is it mandated that the legislature help to craft, and I'll read just the bill description before I get into the outcome. It says the legislature plans to continue the important work of dismantling institutional racism in public schools and recognizes the importance of increasing equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism and cultural competency training throughout the entire public school system by providing training programs for classified staff, certified instructional staff, certified administrative staff, superintendents, and school directors that will be provided in an ongoing manner. It says beginning in the 2023-2024 school year, which is, of course, the school year that we are currently in, and every other school year thereafter, school districts must use one of the professional learning days funded under the RCW to provide to school district staff a variety of opportunities for training, professional development, and professional learning aligned with the cultural competency, equity, diversity, and inclusion standards of practice developed by the Washington Professional Educator Standards Board. So the sole purpose of this bill passed in 2021 was to make sure that during this school year, there were a lot of training opportunities for teachers focused on equity, focused on DEI, at a time when the basics is very far below par. Math, reading, writing, arithmetic, all that be damned, or test scores are in the toilet. But yeah, let's pass a state law that mandates training for teachers on DEI. Before I get into some of the training that teachers in our state are going to be going through in the next few months as a result of this bill, let me just say for the record, diversity is a great thing. Diversity is absolutely a strength. Inclusion is a wonderful thing. Having teachers who value those things, having teachers who, yeah, can look at their class and look at the different cultural norms of students and make sure that their kids feel included, that is not a bad thing. That's a very, very good thing. I would also argue that 99.9% of teachers are capable of doing that on their own because they're good people. And they want people to feel included. And they're not racists or white supremacists who need to be trained for hours and hours on end about how to be inclusive. I think that's either part of someone's personality and part of their desires as a teacher, or it's not. I don't believe the government needs to mandate it. And I certainly don't believe that given the test scores in this state, we need to have teachers spend even a minute this year taking some of these courses. So this is listed on the Washington Education Association website for teachers to sign up for these training sessions. And I'm going to read, this isn't even all of them. This isn't even all of them. Here are some of the training sessions that teachers in our state are going to be going to in the first few months of the year. Culturally responsive art instruction. Equity literacy. Culturally responsive classroom management. Awareness of current institutional inequities. Diversity, equity, and cultural competence in classroom instruction. Intro to cultural identity and diversity. Let's continue. Ethics standard knowledge of equitable behavior. Cultural competence standard valuing diversity. Integrating wellness monthly themed focus breathe for social justice. What does that even mean? It's described as course will include powerful social emotional learning strategies and tools that teachers and students can implement together in the classroom and or on their own. These strategies empower teachers to show up as their best selves and help students focus on their minds, connect their bodies, regulate their emotions. What in the world? Is this a therapy session or is it a classroom? Embracing diversity with true colors. Teaching global competence. Exploring and unpacking bias. Educators will be able to define and describe implicit and explicit bias and identify how bias influences decisions, actions, and behaviors with students and families. This is the stuff that state lawmakers are pushing on teachers in our state. By law. At a time when English testing scores are in the toilet. Math test scores are in the toilet. Reading, writing, in the toilet. At a time when 67% of kids are showing up for class on a regular basis. And we're focused on, what was that first one? Culturally responsive art instruction? And state state lawmakers did this. They spent time doing this. Whenever I see stuff like this, I just think that the politicians who push it believe everyone is a racist. Whether it's an outward racism or a deep-seated inward racism. All these teachers, if I were a teacher, I'd be genuinely offended that you thought, as politicians, that you needed to shove down my throat hours of training so I could respect different cultures, so I could respect different skin colors. How deeply offensive is that? And that's not the only sort of training modules that teachers in our state are going to be going through while they ignore or are forced to ignore because politicians force them to ignore the very basics of education. Climate change. What extent do we believe climate change should be taught in our classrooms? And if you think it should, what should the classes look like? Well, according to the state, some of the training includes training classes such as climate justice. Climate change 101. Community outreach for climate change. Mitigating climate change. Integrating climate change into classrooms. Adapting to climate change. Now look, I am all for, from a scientific perspective, talking about the environment and the climate and stressors and impacts. That's not what this is. Climate justice. Educators will learn about the disproportionate impact climate change has on some population groups, i.e. people of color. And we continue to put people in office who think that this is the priority. $17,000 per pupil in Washington State. Test scores in the toilet. Attendance in the toilet. Enrollment in the toilet. And we're going to ask teachers in the state over the next few months to take training like this? This is how activist teachers are born. This is how activist teachers are inspired through policy and through law to knowingly or unknowingly indoctrinate their kids on political and social issues. I don't know, is there a parent in the world that hears that list of training and thinks this is how we should be spending time training our teachers? Maybe a couple, I guess, if some of the lawmakers who pass these policies are parents themselves. This is not the kind of stuff that's preparing our kids for the next generation. This is not the kind of stuff that's preparing young adults and teenagers to help the United States be competitive on a global field. And honestly, this is the kind of stuff, if you're going to have classes and training that's all around equity and bias and institutional racism, that might help like the 0.01% of teachers who might actually be racist. Maybe it's good for them to hear, but it does nothing for the vast majority of teachers who are already treating every single child in their classroom with dignity and respect. I think it's pretty bad that politicians have such a low opinion of teachers as individuals. I'll also say, and I asked this, by the way, of the daily on our daily subscriber poll on Patreon and Locals about the issue of climate change in schools, because I tend to believe it shouldn't be ignored. I'm not saying that it should be ignored. But do I think climate justice is something that our teachers should be in spewing to kids? Of course not. So the question I asked on Patreon and Locals, should climate change be taught in Washington State public schools? Yes, including societal impacts. Yes, but only scientific teachings, or no? The vast majority of you tend to agree with me on this issue. Yes, but only from a scientific perspective. Because or else you're getting into opinion and you're getting into social and political issues and agendas. Although 31% right now are saying no, it shouldn't be taught at all. And that might be because of the distrust. That might be, we talked about this with a Republican proposal to improve Holocaust education in schools. Do I think that's a good thing on its face? Yes. Do I trust that it will be implemented free of any sort of weird pro-Palestine bias? No. A couple answers to that. Kevin Gaylord says, adding all these issues all adding all these side issues are part of why the schools are so messed up. Like any good business would do, step back, refocus on your core goals, and rebuild. What creates a competent adult from a child? Reading, writing, arithmetic, true history, athletics, music, and add money management. I agree. And I'm glad that you also added in, you know, talking about history, athletics, and music. You know, athletics and music, they're not part of the core sort of instruction, but they build better human beings. They foster your creativity. They help with your health and your wellness. Those are important things for kids. Drilling it into a child's brain, like a white kid that, you know, you're part of institutional racism, and drilling it into a black kid's brain that all the systems are designed to hold you down, you'll never amount to anything. That's not what we should be talking about in schools. Harold Byrne says, if we could find a way to drain the political indoctrination from the subject, I'm in favor of teaching the science behind climate change. But we should also teach the history of it as well. When I was a wee lad, the headlines were warning of the coming ice age and how we'd have a snowball Earth in the next 20, no 30, no 100 years. Then global warming, now some nebulous apocalyptic change. They cannot consistently predict weather in 24 hours, much less a decade in the future. And that's true, too. You could want a topic taught in schools, but it's all about the implementation. It's all about who crafts it, who approves it, and how it's implemented, and then ultimately up to individual teachers on following that curriculum and that agenda and that direction, which we know doesn't always happen. So I wanted to go through this in excruciating detail like we did with all these classes today, because it would be easy to look back, you know, at 2021 and completely forget about Senate Bill 5044, as is often the case. You know, we have a legislative session starting next week, and there are going to be a lot of bills, and you might see outrage and pushback against them now, and then they pass, and then it just sort of disappears. And certainly that's what could happen with this one. Oh, it just disappears. Oh, this was creating training programs for teachers around DEI. Okay, but now is the school year where it goes into effect. And now we see exactly what those training programs look like. And as expected, they are going to be a complete waste of time. All right, coming up next, Ann Bremner is going to join us. She represented one of the Tacoma police officers who was acquitted in the death of Manny Ellis last week. And so we're going to talk to her about the outcome in that case, about what her client went through, and about whether he sees a future for himself as a Tacoma police officer or a police officer anywhere else. But first, I've been talking about the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program. We've been doing ads for them for a year. I had great personal success on the program. And just a huge thank you to Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team, because I love every single time I get an email or a Facebook comment from a viewer who lost weight on the program. I'm just so grateful that we started with Eastside as a partner, because it really has been life-changing. I mean, I was able to lose 37 pounds before my wedding. So grateful for that. So it's a new year, January 2nd. I know a lot of people make New Year's resolutions. If your New Year's resolution is to get on track, to lose a little weight, just get healthier, have more energy, Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program might be for you. Schedule a free 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team, eastsideweightlossclinic.com, eastsideweightlossclinic.com. You can ask any questions you want before you commit. And I think that's really important, because, and even Dr. Ryan Coogan has said this before, that not every weight loss program is right for every person. This might not be the right weight loss program for you, but you won't know until you ask questions about it. So the consultation is free, eastsideweightlossclinic.com. All right, we've talked a little bit, really on the Sunday show, but we mentioned it briefly yesterday, about the acquittal of three Tacoma police officers in the 2020 death of Manny Ellis in Tacoma. And this, like a lot of issues involving police officer use of force, became a public spectacle. These officers were convicted in the court of public opinion, both in the activist corners and by the mainstream media, long before they ever had their day in court. But once they went to trial, once a jury of their peers heard all of the evidence, they acquitted each officer of every charge against them. Here's this moment.
We, the jury, find the defendant Christopher Shane Burbank not guilty of the crime of murder in the second degree. We, the jury, find the defendant Christopher Shane Burbank not guilty of the crime of manslaughter in the first degree as charged. We, the jury, find the defendant Matthew J. Collins not guilty of the crime of murder in the second degree. We, the jury, find the defendant Matthew J. Collins not guilty of the crime of manslaughter in the first degree. We, the jury, find the defendant Timothy Eugene Rankine not guilty of the crime of manslaughter in the first degree.
Yeah. So after that happened, the coverage of it was predictable. I mean, I was a little, I mean, there's some outlets where I'm like, that's how I expect them to cover it, like The Stranger, et cetera. The Seattle Times, though, gosh, every once in a while, they truly disappoint me. And this is one of those instances. You know, you had this unprecedented situation. The first time the Attorney General's office under Bob Ferguson has ever charged an officer with murder, let alone three officers charged in a death. And you had an acquittal. And it's Attorney General Bob Ferguson's 0 for 4 when it comes to prosecutions against police officers. So rather than the media looking at, okay, should these cases have even been brought in the first place? Is there any sort of political implications here? Is there any sort of political agenda here? No, they paint it as a miscarriage of justice. This article in The Times, which was written by a columnist, which to me and to my trained eyes as a former journalist, says it's an opinion piece, but as Nicole had pointed out on the Sunday show, it was not clearly labeled as an opinion piece, which I thought was really disappointing. It also really misleading to readers. The Times wrote in this, no justice for Manny Ellis in trial of Tacoma police officers. It says, while the trial itself would likely not have happened if not for the gains of I-940, the way the trial was conducted and its outcome was reminiscent of the same stacked deck that has characterized police accountability cases in the U.S. since forever. So again, they're painting, even after a jury, you know, multiple investigations into these officers' actions, a full jury trial, full airing of the evidence, as Jay Inslee called it, and then acquittal for each of the officers. And still the media says that that just means there's a stacked deck, as opposed to saying, okay, well, maybe that means that they were innocent. Maybe that means that they were truly innocent under the law. So Anne Bremner is an attorney who we've had on the show before because she takes on a lot of high-profile cases. In fact, she was a defense attorney for Pierce County Sheriff Ed Troyer, who was prosecuted by the Attorney General's office and then acquitted, just like these three officers. So she was hired to represent Officer Timothy Rankin, who his role in this is interesting because he wasn't one of the two officers who were charged with murder who were initially on scene. He was charged with manslaughter and he had been called to the scene to assist. So Anne Bremner was his attorney. He was obviously acquitted of all charges. She agreed to come on and talk to us not only about that moment and what that officer has been through, but also about the larger political environment. Anne Bremner, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So this is the second time you've represented a law enforcement officer who has been charged by the Attorney General's office. It's the second time your client has been acquitted. Are these just weak cases, or are you a good attorney, or both?
I wish I was that good of an attorney to attribute all of the these results to my, you know, work. But the fact is that, A, I had other people working with me in Sheriff Troyer's case, the first one he mentioned, and also in Tim Rankin's case, the Ellis case. A lot of help, a lot of talent. But also, I don't think this, either of these cases should ever have been brought. We only know two of these cases against law enforcement brought by the AGs were brought in Pierce County, and I defended both of them. And I don't believe that either case should have seen the light of day in a courtroom. It at least should not have. It should have been more. They should have been more carefully scrutinized. I'll say that at a minimum.
Yeah, we'll get to that at the end, because I think that is part of this broader conversation. You know, the AG's office being 0 for 4 in prosecutions against police. I certainly have my opinion. I'm sure it's similar to yours. But we've seen, you know, we saw the moment that not only Officer Rankin, but the other officers involved were acquitted by a jury of their peers. What was that moment like sitting there next to him?
I cried. He cried. My co-counsel cried. I didn't expect to, but it was so overwhelmingly emotional, Brandy, that, you know, 3 months of trial, you know, years of this case dragging on. Our client had 10, 50 members of his family in there every day, his parents, his in-laws. It was just overwhelming. And such, we felt such gratitude to the jury for their hard work and consideration of the facts, the true facts.
Yeah, and look, I'm not going to discount the pain and the emotion for Manny Ellis's family either. I mean, there's no winners in this case. However, the media coverage has sort of solely focused on the reaction of Manny Ellis's family and the emotion from that side. But can you characterize what your client has been through over the past 2 years?
I almost liken it to something that's like Kafka-esque. Remember the book The Trial by Franz Kafka? I think he was from the Czech Republic, and you don't even know why you're there. You know, you thought you did everything right. These officers all said right after it happened, we didn't see anything, you know, to scrutinize. Of course, it was a tragedy. But, you know, I think Officer Collins said, never in my wildest dreams did I ever dream I would be in a courtroom, let alone a criminal courtroom. So it's been very difficult. And we heard from Officer Ford, my client's partner. His name's Messiah Ford, and he was not charged. He's African-American, and he's been called a racist. He's been threatened. He's gotten off social media. So it's not just the officers themselves, but there's a lot of, you know, the collateral damage to people in this case, including families. And the final thing I'll say on that is they were all getting together, the family of my client, Officer Rankin, at Thanksgiving, and they started talking about Christmas, and they all got silent because they were like, are we going to be together at Christmas? Or is Timothy going to be in jail? I mean, that's what they've dealt with for a long time.
Yeah. Well, and certainly the unknown and the uncertainty around that isn't over. I mean, he's been acquitted on the criminal charges, which is obviously good for him and for his family. But we're expecting really any day now the Tacoma Police Department to decide his fate as a police officer with that agency. Mm-hmm. What is your expectation there?
Well, you never want to say never, of course, Brandy, as you know, but I just can't imagine how after this detailed examination of this case with all the witnesses and all the evidence could have any different result with disciplinary action versus this jury verdict in a criminal case where the burden, of course, is pretty high for the state to prove, but there were no policy violations. There was no testimony about anything that would lead to a conclusion they should be disciplined, let alone terminated.
But at the same time, you know, the mayor of Tacoma came out 2 years ago prior to mm-hmm. any sort of trial and said these officers should be fired. So I guess I'm trying to square that comment now with the political wins and the decision that they have before them.
Sometimes, you know, people get out ahead of their skis, over their skis. And I know that she has come back and walked back some of those comments, which I credit, you know, her for. That was an initial reaction that she had. It was unfortunate. And it turns out that what she had to say wasn't borne out by the facts once there was a full examination of the evidence.
That being said, you know, it's a question of, I know that the police chief came out and said after the verdict that within 2 weeks they'd have a decision. I believe 2 weeks would be this Thursday or Friday. So there's a question of what are they going to do in terms of any discipline for these officers. But there's also the question of whether your client, Officer Rankin, wants to be an officer anymore.
Exactly.
Does he want to continue to serve as a Tacoma police officer?
You know, Brandy, I can't really tell you that right now. I think he's given that a lot of thought, but he hasn't really landed, you know, in terms of a position on that. I can tell you that Sheriff Ed Troyer offered to hire all three of these officers. You know, which I really, you know, he's a great guy. Of course, I represented him and he was acquitted in an AG case, but I really appreciated that. And the officers did too. But I don't think there's a definitive answer yet from Timothy Rankin. He was a kid when he came on when this happened. He was a brand new officer. He was by far the most junior. He'd barely, you know, gotten into the job when all this happened. And he was a backup officer. He didn't know what happened. He got there and helped to restrain somebody that was violently resisting the police. And then he ended up charged with manslaughter.
Yeah, and in that regard, for people who didn't follow the trial every day, and if you've had a chance to talk to the jury, obviously it's a little bit of a different case for your client for the reason you just expressed. He was called there mm-hmm. on backup. He wasn't there for the entirety of the ordeal. Are there specific pieces of evidence that you believe really contributed to the jury verdict, to the acquittal?
Yeah, there are a number of things. Number one, they did say that they did not find those quote-unquote eyewitnesses that were so heralded in the print media to be truly credible. And it was put out again and again and again that eyewitnesses said that the officers were aggressors. There was video evidence, but it was very partial, and they had to enhance it. There was audio evidence. They had to enhance it. So obviously, it's not what was seen that night. It's not what was heard that night. And those quote-unquote eyewitnesses were balanced out by witnesses on the other side that said there was a struggle, there was a brawl, that Ellis was throwing around the officers, quote unquote, pretty good. So that was one piece. And that was a lot of what they said their case was, the AG. But the medical examiner himself, Dr. Clark, kind of the star witness, he said on cause of death that he couldn't say particularly that there was one particular cause of death. He talked about a spit hood. He talked about meth in the fatal range that he said could be considered, quote unquote, the primary factor in the death. And when he was cross-examined, he basically would say, you know, I cannot definitively give you this cause of death with this individual, even though it was reported that he did. It was really a mixed bag. So how can you convict if you don't know how he died? How can you convict someone of murder or manslaughter, killing someone, if you don't even know if that person or persons had something to do with the death, the mechanism of the death? So those are big things. But I think the officer's testimony was big. I think they're very credible. I think Officer Ford was very credible. And the jury heard what happened. Great jury, attentive jury. 3 months, you know, they came in every day. And they were never missed a day, didn't miss a beat. There were some COVID illnesses where people had to step aside. But I was so impressed with this jury. You know, there were protesters out front. There were all kinds of, I think, pressures on them. And they did exactly what they were there to do. They rose to occasion, something bigger than themselves, and rendered a true verdict based on the facts and the evidence.
And you mentioned, you know, something that's important, and this goes for any sort of use of force incident with a police officer that winds up in the news. You have court, and then you have the court of public opinion. You've got a mayor who says, fire them, you know, before they've had their day in court. You've got the media, as you said, after this verdict, it was painted in many news publications as a miscarriage of justice, as a stacked deck. I mean, the Seattle Times article we've talked about on our show. I guess... is there ever going to be a way around, you think, you know, having gone through this with two police officers now being acquitted, is there ever going to be a way around this sort of different standard that officers are held to in the court of public opinion?
I did write a book, and I'm not plugging the book, except for it's called Justice in the Age of Judgment. I wrote with my brother about media impact on these criminal trials, high profile trials. And I bring it up because you magnify that tenfold in a police case, as you know, and especially after the quote unquote summer of love or the, you know, pandemic and unrest we had in 2020 when this case was charged. So I've defended police officers, you know, for 35 years, Seattle, Portland, King County, Bellevue, and in wrongful death cases and use of force cases. But I've never seen it quite like this in the last 3-4 years of how difficult it is to represent police officers. The pendulum swings. I hope people get to understand we need public safety. We need good officers. And we can't vilify people and take a whole movement and put it into a criminal case and convict the innocents, those that didn't do anything wrong, based upon our sentiments about bigger policy and societal issues and police issues.
Yeah, and that's where I want to take this. You know, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, not to make this political,
right.
I believe these were political prosecutions. I've said that publicly. You've got an attorney general who is now, as I said, 0-for-4 in prosecutions brought against police officers. And this is someone who very well may be the next governor of Washington State. I mean, do you believe that these are decisions that are being impacted by political considerations?
Well, I've said that publicly before. And I said that in Sheriff Troyer's case, you know, that was something that was politically driven, that there was not evidence to support that charge. And we tried to get that in front of a jury. The judge said no, but I did argue in motions. It was politically driven by someone who was considering running for governor. In this case, there were, I think, 7 attorney general, assistant attorney general lawyers, a number of them in private practice at great expense to the public. You have to wonder, you know, why this case? I've tried other cases where police had deaths ensue, unfortunately and tragically, like in this case, with some lawful restraint. Methamphetamine or cocaine toxicity or overdose, excited delirium, and other heart problems, atherosclerotic disease, and types of weakened hearts from drug use. So I've seen exactly this kind of scenario in the past. And those were cases where at inquests, officers were cleared. But then this case, given the timing, and I think by whom it was brought, we have to look at why was this brought, when it was brought in, look at what the officers went through. I don't think it should have been charged.
Yeah. And you bring up lawful restraint. And look, you know, laws have changed as a result of this. And that's fine if you look at tactics that officers use and lawmakers want to change things. But you still have to judge the officers based on what their training and what was allowed at the time that this happened. And let's end with this. Is there anything your client, in hindsight, would have done differently that night?
You know, that's a good question for him. I've never asked him that, but I think the answer would be no. He feels terribly that Manny Ellis died. I know Manny Ellis was very loved by his family. I got to know his sister, his mom. They're wonderful people. He had a lot of supporters and family. And I think the loss of a life is something that you wish would never happen. And he did testify to that. You know, he got emotional about it and said, you know, I just wish this had never happened. But it did. And hopefully we can all learn from it, including as to whether or not these cases should go forward. And I do want to say to the family again, we know it's a tragedy. And they've really lost somebody special to them.
All right, Ann Bremner, I think that's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us and for getting involved in these cases that are difficult politically. They're difficult from a public opinion perspective. And I really think that you're owed a debt of gratitude for the types of cases that you choose to get involved in. So thank you.
Well, thank you. You are owed a debt of gratitude for everything you do, including in the other Ellis case, Brandy, where on the sentencing that you highlighted for people in terms of an injustice in Pierce County that occurred during this trial, or almost occurred, but didn't.
Yeah. It was good to see a different outcome in that case. And thanks.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'll just say, you know, at any time, we should be hearing whether there'll be any sort of discipline from the Tacoma Police Department for these officers. I share Ann's sentiments that, you know, given the investigations, given the evidence that was presented at trial, I can't see how they could do that unless it was political, which I'm not ruling out. But I find it very unlikely that any of these officers would continue on with the Tacoma Police Department and even in the profession. I mean, when you really think about what they went through for the past 2 years, the way they've been vilified by activists and by the media, how could they continue to patrol the streets of Tacoma? I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't want my loved one to do it. And so, you know, there's going to be a broader conversation moving forward about Bob Ferguson and about the way that he's utilized his office. And police officers aren't perfect. Is it possible and have in the past police officers used force excessively? Of course. That would be ridiculous to suggest otherwise. But you are 0 for 4, Bob Ferguson, on prosecuting police officers who have been cleared by a jury of their peers. And if that doesn't do some soul searching for you or your supporters to really, really find out, were these cases that were sound? Were these cases that would have been brought in any other scenario? I mean, this is not something that I'm going to let go as long as he's running to be the governor of Washington State. And I can only hope that the people of this state choose someone who is more qualified for the job in terms of not using the power of their offices to go after citizens of the state of Washington. All right, coming up next, remember Jason Roth, the quote-unquote homeless landlord in Seattle, who we've had on the show before? Well, a far-left blogger is now saying that his story is just crumbling before our eyes and that there's no truth to it. Well, we're going to respond to that blogger coming up in the next segment. But first, it's a new year. If you are trying to maybe save a little money, budget for your family, insurance is a good place to start. The insurance market is really weird right now. I mean, with crime through the roof, having an advocate on your side to navigate the insurance industry is a very, very good thing. Mike and I are members of the First Mark family. We took the First Mark Challenge back in the spring, took a little time, did a virtual meeting with them, talked about our insurance needs. They went out, they shopped the market for us, came back, we got better insurance for the same price. So it was a no-brainer. And I've heard from people who are saving hundreds of dollars a month by going through First Mark for their insurance needs. Dave Taylor is the CEO of First Mark.
We like to talk about there's three elements to a really healthy insurance program. Yeah. It's having the right coverage. It's having the right coverage at a competitive rate. And it's having the service behind it when you need it, right? So all three things are really important. However, people are bombarded with the message of price, right? So when people reach out to us, it's okay that they all pretty much reach out and say, hey, mm-hmm. I want to see if I can save some money.
And can you do it in 15 minutes or less?
Yeah. No. And the answer is no.
No, we can't. Okay. No. Yeah, it'll take a little more than 15 minutes, but you could save a whole bunch of money, get better insurance in the process, and just have an advocate on your side to navigate the market for you right now is a really, really smart thing. So firstmarkinsurance.com, firstmarkinsurance.com. Take the First Mark Challenge in the new year. First Mark Insurance, they work for you. All right, let's get something clear. Clarity. Nicole's like, oh God, what? Being wealthy or working hard for what you have does not entitle lazy people to your things. That is called socialism. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. You've probably heard of Jason Roth by now. He's been all over the media as a poster child for Seattle tenant protections gone awry. Jason Roth, young guy, I think he's 32 years old. Is he 32 still? 33, somewhere in there. early 30s. Young guy, worked hard, got a rental property for himself, fixed it up in South Seattle, only to become a landlord in a city where it is probably the most difficult place in the United States to be a landlord because of the strict protections put in place for tenants. And immediately, one of his tenants started taking advantage of those protections and didn't pay him rent. And this, because of the protections in place, has turned into an almost year-long ordeal where Jason Roth has what really amounts to a squatter squatting in his home, not paying rent, unable to evict him, courts backed up, and truly a nightmare scenario. Jason Roth has come on the show now multiple times to talk about why he decided to speak up about this.
There just has to be some sort of narrative shift that's that, like, landlord, and if you own a business and you own a house, you're not inherently evil. Like I love to fix things and improve things, just like someone might like to go out and, you know, people buy and restore furniture. Like, I saved up forever because I wanted to buy an old house and fix it up and rent it to my friends. I'm getting punished. I keep trying to rack my brain. Why? Like, what did I do to get this short end of the stick?
Yeah, and one of the other reasons I think his story took off is just the ridiculousness of it. You know, he has a camper van, he has a cute little dog, and he was spending some nights in his camper van because he wasn't getting any rental income from this home, didn't want to then turn around and spend money on an apartment. And so it's just this sad, sad, sad story that really illustrates how screwed up the laws are and how they work against working people. So Jason's story gets picked up absolutely everywhere. The Seattle Times ends up letting him write an op-ed. So he did that. He published an op-ed in the Times. The headline, "Small Landlords Are at the Mercy of Broken King County Eviction Court." And he talked about this whole legal ordeal he's been through. You know, months without being paid rent. Shows up in court only for them to kick the can down the road. Now he's looking at a year plus before he can even get a decision here for a court to order this guy evicted. And then actually carrying out the eviction is a whole nother process. So we do the story. Jason Rance does the story. Gosh, there were, I think, the Daily Mail, Cairo 7 investigators, Get Jesse does the story. So it's all over the place. And then over the holiday break, while I was gone, the article was published on December 22nd. A far left publication called Publicola in Seattle, which is intentionally progressive, and that's certainly their right. We give our opinion on their show. But they had done, prior to the Christmas break, this stupid article that basically said that the phrase mom and pop landlords is racist. So that just gives you an idea of the mindset or the perspective that these people are coming from. So anyway, they published this article that they held up as a blockbuster, just tearing down Jason Roth's story. The headline, "Nightmare Tenant Story Amplified by Seattle Times Crumbles Under Scrutiny." It says, while news stories may mention Roth making mortgage payments on the Beacon Hill rental house, there's no evidence of a mortgage or deed of trust in the land records. Instead, it appears to be owned outright by an LLC of which Roth's father, Kerry Roth, is the only listed governor and executor. The same LLC owned a West Seattle beachfront home worth over $2 million, which was transferred to Roth's parents in 2022. In an interview, Roth seemed surprised that he was not listed as the sole member of the LLC. He said, "I do make payments on the house, but it's a private loan," Roth said, then declined to elaborate. "I don't want to discuss my personal finances," he said. The author, Katie Wilson, goes on to say, "I wouldn't expect Jason Rance and Brandy Cruz, two local conservative talking heads who helped amplify Roth's version of events, to let the truth spoil a politically useful story. But the Seattle Times really should have done some fact-checking. A little digging reveals a different picture." So I'm going to get to the general takeaway of the Publicola story. But they say there, and the suggestion is, that because Jason Roth has this home was purchased through a personal loan and not through a bank, that somehow negates the situation that he's in. Now, I will say, I did bring up, in the first time we had Jason Roth on, just because I want to go point for point here on what Publicola is saying and what we've talked about on the show, Jason Roth's story. I did bring up, the first time we had him on, the mortgage situation, and asked him basically, well, why don't you just, is there some point where you default on the mortgage? Here's that brief exchange. "Are you considering any sort of extreme measures, like not paying the mortgage or anything like that, even though that hurts you?"
No, I'm going to continue paying bills. It's fine.
Yeah. So was that an opportunity for Jason Roth to say, hey, well, you know, there's not a bank involved. This home was purchased using money from a trust. Sure. But whether the home was purchased through a private loan or through a bank does not change the fact that the guy living in the house isn't paying rent. So just a little bit of information that we've received on what the mortgage was. So Jason worked in his 20s, saved for a down payment, and then took out a loan from a family trust, which is legal, which he can do. So, and I would assume that's money he would be entitled to later on in life anyway. It would be family trust.
Well, I think they have it set up as a Roth family LLC. LLC. So it's set up as an LLC.
Yeah. So he took out a private loan from the family trust, but he is still paying it off. So he's still required to pay it off. He's still making payments.
With interest.
With interest. He fixed up the house. His plan was to fix it up to rent it out and pay off that loan, then live off the rent and pay bills while he's studying to become a pilot. That's a very responsible young man. Just because his family has money, this isn't a scenario where his daddy bought him the house and he lives in it for free. This isn't a scenario where daddy bought him a house, he's renting it out and collecting all the money from it. No, is there a family trust? Yes. Is it a private loan that he used to buy the house? Yes, but he put in the hard work. He saved for a down payment. He fixed up the house to make it a rental property, to have it be a source of income for himself. That's something that we should celebrate, not something that we should vilify or suggest that because it's not a loan through a bank, it's totally fine for someone to live there and not be paying rent. It's not fine. Doesn't matter how wealthy you are or how rich your family is, no one else is entitled to something that belongs to you, entitled to be there for free. Now, I'll also say, Publicola goes on, and again, the headline, story amplified by Seattle Times, crumbles under scrutiny. Nowhere in this whole article they do does Jason Roth's story crumble under scrutiny. They look at it through a different lens, and that is through the lens of socialism. So one of the other key aspects to Jason Roth's story is the revelation that this bum tenant, and I'm just going to call him a squatter, was renting out part of this house on Airbnb. And when we had Jason Roth on, just to give you context here, he said he would not have cared that this person was renting out part of it as an Airbnb. He's totally on board with that. If the person was paying him rent. What he was mad about, as he articulated on our show, is that this guy's squatting in his house, listing it on Airbnb to make money, and then not paying him any money. Okay? That's the fact. And that's crazy. Here's how Publicola spins it. The property in question is a duplex, and Hunter, who's the squatter, first rented the upper unit in March of 2020 through a company called Loftium, which furnished the lower unit as an Airbnb. It's because Jason Roth had bought this house and Loftium was basically managing the rentals for it. So while Jason Roth owned it and was paying mortgage payments, he had a third party that was vetting renters, etc. And that's how Hunter first came to be in the unit. It says, Loftium had furnished the lower unit as an Airbnb, and Hunter received a modest rental discount for functioning as an on-site host and cleaning the unit between guests. Hunter said the experience was awful. It wasn't an auspicious location in a commercial area off Rainier Avenue and near a homeless encampment. Loftium kept the unit full by dropping the price. Near the end of Hunter's first year-long lease, he and Roth discussed a new arrangement in which Hunter would rent the whole property for $4,300 a month and run the Airbnb himself. In March of 2023, they signed a new lease that explicitly allowed this. It said, tenants shall be permitted to engage a commercial short and or midterm rental website listing service and any other brokerage or marketplace for short or midterm rentals. According to Hunter, he didn't want an eviction on his record. So let me just back up for a second. So the agreement he signed up for with Jason Roth explicitly allowed an Airbnb, which Jason Roth told us. He had no problem with it being used as an Airbnb, as long as the guy was paying rent.
That's the key here, right? Which he's not. So anyway, when Hunter immediately isn't paying any rent to Jason Roth, Roth wants to evict him, as any reasonable person would who deserves to get money for the property that they own. Publicola says, according to Hunter, he didn't want an eviction on his record. Oh, well, maybe you should pay rent if you don't want an eviction on your record. So he asked Roth if he could leave and pay Roth what he already owed, plus whatever Roth wanted for breaking the lease, 1 or 2 months' rent. But Roth demanded full payment for the remaining 9 months of the lease. Roth denies that he ever demanded full payment or that Hunter even made this offer. And there is no writing that's basically this squatter's word. Oh, I offered to leave when I wasn't paying rent, but Jason Roth wouldn't let me leave unless I paid all 9 months. Does that sound realistic? You really think that Jason Roth somehow forced this squatter who wasn't paying him rent to stay unless a squatter who wasn't paying rent paid him all 9 months? That makes no sense in any universe in the world. If you are renting a property and they're not paying rent, and the guy offers you, well, I'll pay you what I owe you and then I'm going to leave, you're going to take him up on that offer. So that just, it's insane to even, for Publicola, even as fringe leftist activists as they are, to buy that. It goes on, and I'll also say, like I said, Jason Roth told us, I'm fine with an Airbnb, but you have to pay rent. That's very reasonable. So they also got in some final slams at Jason Roth for being rich, basically, in this Publicola story. It says there is also an industrial property directly adjacent to the rental home worth $1.3 million named Jarbo Collection in the King County property records. Jarbo is a chain of boutiques co-owned by Roth's mother and sister. Roth's LinkedIn page, which he said is outdated, lists him as a production manager at the company. He said he now works as an apprentice to an aircraft mechanic. Life in what appears to be a custom GMC camper van is, I'm guessing, still much more comfortable than what the 13,000 to 41,000 King County residents living in vehicles, tents, shelters, and doorways experience on a daily basis. Hold on a second here. So again, this is Publicola vilifying Jason Roth for having a successful family and suggesting that because he lives in a camper van, that we shouldn't feel bad for him because he's not living in a doorway. Think about how wild that is. I mean, that is a story told through the lens of socialism. That because Jason Roth is from a relatively successful family, this squatter is entitled to live in his home rent-free, and we shouldn't feel bad for Jason Roth because he's living in a GMC camper van and not out on the streets. That's a crazy mindset. That is a crazy way of looking at things. And it really only makes sense if you believe in socialism. That someone can work very hard for something, buy something, their family can work hard, can pass that wealth along to their children or give them advantages in life. And that gives other people carte blanche to take advantage of them, to claim property for themselves that this person earned or that their family earned. Really crazy stuff. And I'll also say, Jason Roth, in our interviews, never held himself up as destitute, ever.
I mean, could I go find another apartment, like a dirt cheap bedroom somewhere? Probably, but I have school to pay for. I have bills. I have this house to pay for. Like, I don't want to go into debt. I mean, I will sleep wherever I need to make sure I don't, you know, go into debt or start struggling in other ways. I will sacrifice my comfort right now to get this done.
Yeah, he is just financially responsible. Imagine that. Financially responsible. So he's got a camper van, he's got a girlfriend, he's got some family members, he can crash on couches, etc., until the situation is sorted out. But because he's not springing for a $2,000, $2,500 apartment in Seattle while someone fleeces him, we shouldn't feel bad for him? He's never held himself up as destitute. Is he technically homeless? Yes. He doesn't have a house to live in. So the idea that Publicola, based solely on family wealth, is saying that Jason Roth's story is crumbling is insane. That's insane. I'll also note, you know, their whole criticism of not only, you know, me and Jason Rantz, but of Cairo 7 and Jesse Jones and the Seattle Times, their whole criticism is them suggesting that we're just telling this story from Jason Roth's perspective and giving Jason Roth every benefit of the doubt, while being completely oblivious to the fact that they're doing the exact same thing they're accusing us of doing, but for the squatter. And they even acknowledge in their story that they're just kind of taking his word for things, which isn't that what they're saying we did with Jason Roth? They say no one comes out of this story looking blameless or deserving a gold star for good judgment, but even without the pieces for which we have only Hunter's word, the documented reality is a far cry from the media's painting of the tenant as a leech and landlord as a hapless victim. Our widely read daily newspaper should not be amplifying such distortions of the truth. I don't know if first of all, anyone painted Jason Roth as a hapless victim. But the reason this story is newsworthy is very simple. Is that you can have a property in Seattle that you own, be it through a private loan or a bank loan, and someone can live in it and not pay rent for a year or more. And the system makes it really difficult for you to remove them. Those are the facts. This tenant isn't paying rent. And I would also note to Publicola that didn't mention this in their reporting. You have a tenant that is not destitute. You have a tenant that social media shows him spending almost every day at the gym, showing off his abs, out on vacation, checking out yachts, bragging about being on yachts on his social media, having rager parties at the home he's not paying any rent for. So here you have a guy in this squatter who's out there. He's got money to go to the gym. He's got time to go to the gym. Or if someone was destitute, you'd think you'd spend that time working. Has money to go on vacation. Has his hands in all these businesses he says he's trying to run, creating yacht parties, filming himself on yachts, bragging about it, having people over to his house after the club. He can do all that. And Publicola is still going to paint him as sympathetic because he has chosen not to pay rent because he can get away with it. And the only reason they vilify someone like Jason Roth is because he has money and his family has money. And that makes him inherently evil. And that is frankly unbelievable. All right, coming up next, we will get to a story on the national front that we skipped over on the show yesterday, but I want to make sure to talk about today. Oh, we're running long on the show. But first, speaking of, this is actually a good spot to our Sell with Wes spot because we've been talking to Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com about the current environment for landlords. So Wes deals with home sellers, but also oftentimes home sellers are people who were landlords and decided to get out of the game, and now they're selling what were rental units. And he says that because strict landlord-tenant protections have gone into place, now in Tacoma as well, we're likely to see a lot of other units come off the market.
Since 2019, Seattle has lost over 11,000 rental units.
Wow, yeah.
This is important. This is something, you know, like those are less rental units on the market. Majority of those, Brandy, they're not crappy little apartments. Mm-hmm. Those are single family homes. That is the cream of the crop when it comes to, you know, rental inventory. Those are not being sold to other investors. You know, those just, they don't pencil anymore. Somebody's had that for 10, 15, 20 years, you know, and that's going to go to somebody who is going to move, you know, into the city. That is out of the rental pool. That is gone.
Yeah. And for a reasonable person, if you're not making money on a rental property, you're going to sell it because it's not charity, right? As much as Publicola wants it to be charity, it's absolutely not charity. So if you have a rental unit or rental units in Seattle or Tacoma or elsewhere that you just don't know if they're penciling anymore and you want to maybe look at putting them on the market, reach out to Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. He'll give you a free market analysis and he can talk about some of the services that they offer that you're not going to find anywhere else. So sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, dipping outside Washington State quickly, we'll just fit one story in here. You know, I racked my brain. What is it going to take to change the conversation at the border? What is it going to take for both sides to come together and realize that the record number of people who are crossing illegally into the United States is not sustainable? That it is going to dramatically impact our country in a way that cannot be undone? And I really don't think it comes down to the president that's in office. I really don't think it comes down to Congress. I mean, both parties have had control in recent history of both the House, the Senate, and the White House, and not been able to carry out their policy prescriptions for what's happening at the border. Incompetence, blind allegiance, I don't know what it is. I really think the key is getting local elected officials in states across this country, blue states in particular, to say something. To say something, put their political ideology aside, and to start pushing back forcefully against people of their own party who refuse to do what needs to be done. Now, we have seen Mayor Eric Adams in New York City start to be very, very vocal about the influx of migrants into his city and the resources that are being absolutely overburdened. And now we are seeing the brand new far left mayor of Chicago do the same thing.
Whether it's our transportation system, our healthcare system, our education system, you know, all of these systems are already stretched to meet the demands of families who have been here. You know, over the past 7 months, it's been an incredible strain on every aspect of city services.
For many months, we were able to keep the visualization of this crisis from hitting our streets, but we have reached a breaking point. We're no longer able to do that because of the volume in numbers. Just last week, we had 3,900 people that arrived here. We are averaging anywhere from 2,500 to close to 4,000 a week. And if you do the math, you see that's 8,000 every 2 weeks, potentially 16,000 a month that we must feed, clothe, house, educate children, and all the services that you would give a normal adult. And we're seeing that play out on our streets of New York. And that is what the breaking point looks like, what we are experiencing right now.
Now, I'm glad they're saying something. One, it's coming too late. And two, their motivation isn't correct. And Allie Bradley, who's a border correspondent for News Nation, was on the show a couple weeks ago, and she expressed this as well, that what they're doing in speaking out is asking the federal government for more money. They're not asking the federal government to stop the influx of migrants. They just want more money to be able to give them the services that they're now utilizing. That is not a solution to the problem. And what are you going to do when the federal government does not give you more money? Then will we actually see you call for a solution at the southern border? A solution that must include a stop of the flow of migrants into this country? And what I'll say about both of them, you know, you got a liberal Democrat in Mayor Eric Adams, and then, you know, I don't even know what the Chicago mayor is. I'd call him like borderline socialist. That's certainly what he campaigned on. And them speaking out is helpful. It's too late, I will say. It comes way too late. But imagine if we get to a point, I guess it's going to take, you know, an extreme situation, where you've got blue state governors like Jay Inslee, like Gretchen Whitmer, like Gavin Newsom, who start to forcefully push back because we don't have the resources to handle the influx of migrants. And you've got city council members and local lawmakers. I think that that's what it's going to take. And it's most important for it to come to blue state, from blue state governors. Now, I don't know if they're willing to do it, to start doing it. I don't know at what point the situation is so severe that they'll say something. Maybe it's at the point where voters start to really prioritize that issue and it's impacting their lives and they start to vote these people out of office and then their jobs are at risk. And they're like, okay, let me speak out about the obvious. But to me, that's the last line of defense, is local communities and counties and states that realize that what has happened has gotten out of control and that we have to do something about it immediately. It's not enough just for them to say, we need more money. But, you know, I saw my friend Jonathan Cho, he'd posted both those videos and he said, how did we get here? We got here because politicians like them stayed silent until it directly impacted them. And that's political cowardice. They knew what was happening at the southern border. They knew what smaller communities than their cities were going through in Texas, in Arizona. They knew that you had these tiny border towns that were inundated, and they said nothing. They said jack because it wasn't impacting them. Now it is, and now they're speaking up. I'll take it, but it's still political cowardice. And so it's time for other Democratic leaders to speak up before this crisis comes to their doorstep. All right, we'll get to questions and comments from the live stream coming up next. There is a bipartisan proposal. I think we're still working to have the show sponsor on, Nicole, for the education thing. Because there's this all the talk we do about education and laws that lawmakers push through that are really, really bad. There's actually a good one that's bipartisan. It is been introduced by a Republican, but it has the support of the state treasurer, who's a Democrat. And what it would do is it would mandate financial literacy education for high school seniors before they graduate. Well, we've been calling on that for the longest time. And so in light of that proposal, we asked Zach Abraham with Bulwark Capital to weigh in on whether he thinks that would be a good idea.
To even understand how to write a check or what writing a check means, right? What is that money? I remember as a kid, my mom saying at the store, no, we can't afford that. And I remember looking at her and going, Mom, look at all the checks you have left, right? Like, write a check, you know? So I think all kids probably think like that. And you know what's interesting, you bring this up. Our good friend Dory Monson and I used to talk about all the time, as soon as he retired from radio, we were going to do financial literacy classes together for families and things like that. So it's a passion of mine. I'm a firm believer if the average person really, and it's kind of what we try to do on our show to some degree, it's not so much politically aimed, obviously, but financially, trying to explain to people what these things mean, right? Like if you understand what they actually mean, if you understand what's going on, if people knew what was actually going on financially in this country, I am convinced elections would go differently.
I believe the same thing. If you want to listen to Zach's radio show, knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. You can also learn about Bulwark Capital Management's risk management strategy, especially going into 2024, some of the economic indicators, the presidential election, really good time to manage your risk and protect your retirement. So knowyourriskradio.com. All right, questions and comments from the live stream on the teachers being force-fed DEI and climate justice. Andy Stevens says the E in DEI should be changed to equality, but that would go against the progressive agenda. I agree. I have no issue with equality. Equity is something much different. In my mind, equity doesn't improve anyone's outcomes. It holds other people back so people are at an equal playing field, whereas you should give people who are falling behind the tools they need to better their life, and then everyone advances forward. So that's not what I see happening. Cindy Schutman says, I have a friend making a career change, getting certified for becoming a high school math teacher, attending UW in Tacoma, was to graduate in June. He has dropped out and will pivot to Plan B. Says the only thing they care about is DEI. He's being told what we must believe and 100% subscribe to. His ability to teach math is irrelevant. Well, yeah, math's racist. So, but this is what's going to happen, is the teachers who've managed to block all the crazy DEI and not let it influence their teaching, they're going to eventually give up. Frankly, they are. And then you're going to be left with a bunch of activists. And then public school and public education will become irrelevant. Lieutenant Dan 457, public education should teach about how climate change happens, but they should not be pushing students to become activists for climate change. From a historical standpoint, society, why can't I talk today?
I'm not sure.
A, B, C, D, how now, brown cow? That's because I haven't had enough coffee, because I am once again drinking water today.
Wow, look at you.
I'm trying to improve my life. Sorry, Lieutenant Dan, I'll read your comment again. Public education should teach about how climate change happens, but they should not be pushing students to become activists for climate change. From a historical standpoint, societal impacts of climate change should not be ignored, and they should be taught, i.e. changes in climate driving migration of populations. I agree with that. That is kind of scientific, though, and historical, so that's appropriate. Greg Olakis says, this all started with participation trophies.
Truth.
Yeah, it is true. Everyone gets a high five. On Ann Bremner, the attorney for Tacoma Police Officer Timothy Rankin. Bill Biz with a $20 super chat. Thank you, Bill. Ann Bremner is an exceptional advocate. I agree. And Ann mentioned at the back end of our interview the advocacy that we had done in a different case, in same last name, no correlation, in Joshua Ellis, who murdered his ex-girlfriend, Wendy Traynor. And thankfully, a judge realized that the plea deal was way too lenient and gave Joshua Ellis more time. And Ann Bremner had been an advocate for that family as well, pro bono. She does a lot of that pro bono work where she just sees an injustice, and she's a great attorney, and so she steps up to help people. And she really is a gem. Rick Johnson says, luckily, a court where a jury hears actual facts still overrides the court of public opinion and conjecture. structure. It does. It doesn't hurt these officers any less. I mean, you know, they still are. And that's why I say there's no way that those officers want to go back to being Tacoma police officers. And that's a shame. And I don't even know if I'd want to be an officer in Washington State if I were them, considering the guy who politically prosecuted you might be the next governor.
Right.
Is that the environment you want to re-sign up for?
No. And no. I actually just had this conversation because I did some of the research on Jason Roth's piece, because the haters are coming after him hard. Like, hard. These activists are serious business. But it's so small. And I had to say, I hope he doesn't let it get him down.
No, he shouldn't.
Too far. Because it's a frustrating process. And I understand how that gets you down. This year long, like, that's understandably a difficult situation to go through. However, the activists, and I use the example of our Thurston County sheriff backing down from supporting a candidate because the haters came after him. And that's what they want. That's why they do it. They are coming after Jason. They're coming after cops these cops, because they want something and they know it gets people riled up on their side. They want Jason to back down. So they go after him, and it doesn't take much.
They want him to
hurts.
Shut up. They it want hurts. Him to shut up because he's exposing how absolutely right. crooked and wrong the system
right.
is.
And
they want him to shut up because he's not, you know, they're jealous.
Yes,
I
exactly.
mean, honestly, though, they want him to shut up because they're jealous of him.
Right.
They're jealous of him for putting in the hard work, for having, oh my gosh, God forbid, family money.
Right. And the officers, they want cops in general
right.
to back down.
Yes.
So that's why they're doing this. So
well, and they
don't
want criminals.
Cave to these haters. There's,
no.
It's a small portion. We just, it is. They're very loud.
Well, and I love how this blog, Publicola, which is just as far left as The Stranger, wants to, like, make people believe that the collective sort of coverage of this from Jesse Jones, from the Seattle Times, from us, from Jason Rantz, that we're all the ones who are misguided in our interpretation of it.
Mm-hmm.
When, again, you strip out everything about that story, you strip out the personalities involved, all the layers, it boils down to paying rent or not paying rent. Owning the property or not owning the property, it belonging to you or it not belonging to you, and it does not belong to that squatter. Jason there's no reason why Jason let the guy live there because the money for the house came from his family trust. No, again, that's socialism, and I still believe that socialism is supported by a very, very, very small fraction of people, even in a city like Seattle.
I agree.
All right. On the Jason Roth story, Matthew Cook says, Brandy, curious if Publicola ever contacted Jason for his side of the story. They did. And Jason asked me, he's like, Publicola wants to talk to me. Should I talk to them? I said, Jason, they've already decided what story they want to do, but it doesn't hurt. I said,
And then that can't be something they come after, so he wouldn't talk to us.
Right. They're going to do the story regardless.
Right.
I know Publicola is, they had just done the story saying calling mom and pop landlords is white supremacy or in action. So I told him that. You know what kind of story they're going to come up with, but there's really no downside to you talking to them. And maybe you have documents maybe this guy's flat out lying and you can give them documents that show that.
They did. He did. And they chose not to. Chose not to pay attention to them, or to, just like we said, they took one side over the other.
Right.
One word over the other.
To be clear, of all of the things that they exposed and destroyed, the only thing I do wish Jason had been more forthright on is the fact that the home was bought with a family trust. The reason why that does matter is he's not going to lose it to a bank. You know, the family would be like, hey, man, it's okay. I see the situation. He's still making payments. That's the only reason that makes a difference to me.
Just to clarify.
Now, he didn't lie. He never told us that it was through a bank, but I do think he could have been more forthright.
In fact,
I also
mentioned this. The part that I disagree with is he said my personal finances shouldn't be part of it. But once you go public with something like this, you have to know that they are and expect it. And he should have just had a plan for how to explain them, as opposed to just saying, it's not part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, you
it
don't
is.
Have to tell people how much is in your checking account.
No.
And I admire Jason Roth for going public.
Mm-hmm.
If not, and that's a hard thing to do, as you pointed out, in this political environment with the nasty activists who will go after him. I mean, God forbid he ever gets that house back. They'll probably go there and vandalize it every single night until he sells it, right?
Right.
It's a hard thing to do. And
don't give them any ideas.
I don't have to. That's the only tool they have in their little anarchist toolbook is, let's break stuff and write on things.
Spray paint.
Just take a break from our parents' basement.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a lot of courage for Jason to share his story. It's obviously when you come out like that and you make those kinds of allegations about the system, of course it's going to be subject to criticism, rightfully so. That's what you do when you put yourself out there. And yeah, I think that's a lesson for folks. You come forward and share your story, you better be ready for the heat, even if it's unhinged.
But don't let that deter
you. No, don't let it deter you. Just be like, I don't care.
Running for president or governor or whatever, it's going to be hard.
Yes.
And the haters are going to come for you. But don't let it deter you, because that's a small, small percentage of the people.
Haters going to hate, you
know? Haters going to hate.
Our friend Tegan Levine says, is the person living in someone else's home? Yes. Does this person have an agreement to pay to live there? I hope so. If the renter is not paying rent, should they still be able to live there? No. Who cares what the owner is doing? The renter needs to pay rent or get out. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Rachel Cisneros says, just like the rent moratorium, not a care in the world for the landlords who need to pay their mortgage. Exactly. Jason M. says, I hope this shows negatively for his future rental endeavors. And that's what cracks me up, is this guy says, I didn't want an eviction on my record. I wonder what you could do to avoid having an eviction on your record. The other thing I think is interesting here that we didn't get into really quick before we do our closing sanity check, because we're way over time today, and I'm so hungry, you could probably hear my stomach growling, is why don't we do a show at lunchtime and then not eat lunch beforehand?
I know, we need a snack.
At one point when this guy told Jason Roth he wasn't going to be able to make rent, like right away, he said that he was like starting some business, and did Jason maybe want to invest and get a little bit of the return that might manifest instead of paying rent? And Jason was nice enough initially to say, well, sure, like I can do that. And then nothing happened, because that doesn't surprise me. Look at this guy's Instagram account. It seems like he starts all sorts of projects. Mm-hmm. And then Jason's like, well, never mind, I want my money, which I don't blame him for. But doesn't that publicly use that as a negative? To me, that's a positive. He, instead of paying rent, he was going to say, yeah, I'll support your, what is the word I'm looking for?
Your
endeavor, but your entrepreneurship and this new thing you're trying to do, and help you out with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't that make him look good?
Right.
And instead they vilified him for changing his mind.
Well, and what Jason pointed out to us is that typically these cases that get taken to court to the level that he is, often once it gets to almost the decision time, the renter, squatter, says, hey, I'll just walk away or give you some money if you'll just drop it, and the eviction doesn't show up
that's
on their
true
record. So that's often why this is happening, is because they can take it as long as they can take it, and then they can offer to walk away with nothing on their record. And most landlords are so exhausted that they take it.
Yep. And then also the laws restrict what a landlord can share with future landlords, which is so wrong. Yep. And so then you're sticking deadbeat tenants with other landlords down the road, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Right.
So Jason's standing up not only for himself, but for future landlords who are going to get this deadbeat one day, because he's got to live somewhere. Right. And apparently he's not willing to work hard enough to be able to do what Jason did. So it's just all absolutely ridiculous. And shame on Publicola really for pushing the idea that, and again, it's like, even if Jason, I didn't come from money, you know, I've worked very, very hard, and, you know, pushing the idea that if you do that, then everyone else is entitled to your success is absurd. And it also, I think, serves to discourage people from working hard, because you're teaching them that you're going to get things and you're entitled to things, even if you don't put in the work.
Right. And I will say, just on the defensive part for you and for Jason Rance and whatever, they called him out, or called us out for not doing the research, but actually we did.
We got all the documents.
And we have documents, and they didn't, because all the things, they quote a couple documents, but they didn't research deep enough. Like the building across the street is actually not owned by his parents. It's rented. And things like that, that they, and at the end they admit it, they went on his word and didn't get all the documents, just got the ones that worked for the story.
The word of someone who's been squatting in someone else's property for what now, 7 months? Yeah. How long has it been? So yeah.
No slamming us, or we'll come right back at that.
Yeah, you can slam us. I love
it. I know, but know that it's coming back at you.
Yeah. Thank you. okay. Anyway, can we get to our closing sanity check? Speaking of environmental issues. Love Todd Myers. It's going to be the year of Todd Myers. What is he going to expose this year with the Washington Policy Center?
He called during the show, which I'm like, Todd, don't you know that it's during the show right now? But he
why don't you call him quick?
He has a special story for us.
Call him quick.
Really?
Yeah, call him.
Oh, geez.
Anyway, I'll get to my closing sanity check. Todd Myers, so right now in Washington State, Governor Janzi's pushing wind, 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 solar, which makes no sense because, of course, it's cloudy all the time here. And then meanwhile, there's this whole conversation about whether to breach the Snake River dams where you have this really clean, reliable... hi, Todd.
Hang on just a second.
Hey, Todd. You're on, you're live on Undivided.
I'm live on Undivided?
Yes. Yes, you're live on Undivided, so don't...
I got a lot of things to say.
Yeah. If
well,
you had
called during the show.
If you had to choose today, how would you power your home? What form of electricity? Or what form of power?
Modular nuclear.
Oh, good. Okay. That's not what I was expecting. We're about to share your tweet about wind energy.
Oh, okay.
Nicole said you called during the show, so we thought we'd let you know that we are including you in the show today, but we'll call you back after.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, I have a very fun story that you will enjoy that I'm releasing Thursday, and I thought I would give you a heads up.
Oh, that's good. And also, we talked on the show the other day about how gas prices are going to get even worse this year. Is that your prediction and you're sticking to it?
That is absolutely my prediction. And I actually came across evidence. Somebody else found it and I remembered it and went back and looked at my records that Jay Inslee, I have evidence that Jay Inslee knew this would happen.
Wait, is that the story you're going to pitch to us?
Say that again?
Is that the story you're going to pitch to us?
Yeah.
Oh, this is good. Okay. All right, Todd, we're letting you go. We'll call you after the show. I got to wrap up our sanity check.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, in our closing sanity check today. Ooh, that's a good one. Ooh, the juice.
You made him give away the
He's
tease.
Fine. All right, so Governor Janzi's pushing solar, which makes no sense, wind. And then meanwhile, they're like, oh, maybe we should breach these dams that are giving us very reliable hydropower. So he, Tom Myers put out a tweet, across the Pacific Northwest, wind energy disappeared during the holidays. Wind provided less than 1% of energy generation on the BPA system for more than half the time since November 20th. Hydro made up the difference. So at a time when you have Governor Jay Inslee pushing, this is very similar to the gas-powered vehicles. At the time, you know, with the gas, they're like, oh, well, we want people to bike. We want people to take public transit. We want people to use electric vehicles. Methods that are impossible for a lot of Washingtonians, not useful for many, electric vehicles that aren't going to get everyone where they need to go. But you're like, oh, we're going to make gas so expensive. Well, you have no reliable alternative. Same thing here with Governor Jay Inslee pushing things that are not working because they fit a certain agenda. And this goes back to, you know, the sanity part of it that we talked about with education and climate change and how that's taught to kids. Are you going to teach them about things that, hey, would be great for the environment, but they're not quite working, they don't quite meet our needs yet? Or are you going to push those things at any cost and for any reason? All right, that has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Gosh, as Todd just teased there, maybe we got a banger of a story to start the show tomorrow. If you have not become a supporter of the show already, please do so. You can sign up.
Thursday. He said Thursday.
Oh, he's teasing it on Thursday. Okay. You can sign up for $5 a month on DividedPod.com. UndividedPod.com.